Welcome to the Visiting Writers Series here at VCU. We're really glad that you can make it tonight. It's nice to see this turnout. I am Sonia Livingston, and I teach creative nonfiction writing here at VCU. And I have the honor of introducing our first reader tonight. Lina Maria Ferreira Cabeza Venegas also teaches creative nonfiction writing. And I was thinking all day about how to introduce her and why I find her work so exciting. Sometimes I know what I like, but I'm not sure why, right? So I was thinking, like, what is it about her work? And what I went to is the challenges of writing creative nonfiction. For some reason, the same writers who in fiction and poetry workshops let themselves go crazy become very tethered to earth in a nonfiction workshop. I think it's the word nonfiction. Suddenly people often want to write like those what I did over my summer vacation reports that we had to write in fourth grade, right? Suddenly they become a little more detached. They want to make reports. And so the challenge can be to let them know that even though it's nonfiction, you can have the same freedoms as the other genres. What makes Lina's work so exciting is that she knows that. Lots of you know that. I'm preaching to the choir here because you guys are great nonfiction writers, but many times people do get stopped up. Lina's writing is a perfect example to show what can be done with nonfiction. She refuses to be limited. She blows those expected voices and forms and perspectives away. She might report, but she doesn't only ever report. Or she might use memory, but she doesn't ever fully just rely on memory. Her writing refuses to be boxed in by category or type. The essays cut their way into surprising shapes and patterns. I was thinking that they reminded me a little bit, she's not gonna like this analogy and I shouldn't say it right now, I know I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to. They remind me a little bit of those balloons that people, you know, what are those balloons that people stretch into shapes? You don't know where they're gonna go, and then suddenly there's this wild animal over here, and then we've got another one, and they're light, and they take on a shape that is always fresh and always surprising. Her essays move back and forth in time, incorporate the personal with elements of history and cultural criticism and myth. Her work is the perfect example that I want to show students to show the tremendous freedom of the essay as a form, and also what can be done with content. She braids together, often in the same essay and even the same paragraph, violence and tenderness, lyricism and unflinching precision, cultural observation and family stories, which is to say that Lina never lets the word nonfiction keep her earthbound. The result is writing that's alive on the page, textured, gorgeous, brutal. In the preface of her new book, Lina writes about a pair of dead pet hamsters. It's very sad, those hamsters. But she's not only writing about the hamsters. She's taking on many things there. But there is this wonderful image of the hamsters after they die. And her mother examines their bodies and calls the girls, Lina and her sister, over to look at the dead hamsters. And she wants to cut them open. She cuts them open. So in that scene, Lina writes, "My mother aims to slice the world open and have us know it. She'll find dead things in bushes and yards, and half the time she will yield and let us play mortuary and death parade directors. But the other half, she insists. There is truth buried in their chest, and she will slice down the middle, cutting and reciting, anatomy like poetry in a dead mouse, dead bird, dead Vicky and little she Rambo like open books on an altar. My mother unraveled them as if they were full of secret strings you could follow back to the beginning of the universe." Later on that same page, she writes, "The myth of myths is that there's always reason and explanation, a divine entangled thread running through the navel of every breathing buried thing, a story like a hamster's body, like an origami crane, something you can unfold and understand from the creases on the paper in the skin." Whether Lina lets herself test this myth of myths or whether she's seeking primarily to reassemble and better understand, she uses the sharp instrument of her writing as her mother did her scalpel to slice the world open and have us better know it. Lena received two MFAs, actually, in creative nonfiction and literary translation from the University of Iowa. Her books are Drown, Sever, Sing, and Don't Come Back. In addition to essays, she writes poetry, fiction, and translations, and her work appears in journals such as the Bellingham Review, Normal School, The Rumpus, Fourth Genre, and Brevity. She has won the Best of the Net, a Discovered Voices Award from Iron Horse Review, and a Rona Jaffe Fellowship. She moved from Columbia to China to Columbus, Ohio, and lucky for us, to Richmond. Please join me in welcoming Lena Maria Ferreira Cabeza Venegas.
Thank you. That is the nicest thing anyone has ever said about me. And I am going to prove you wrong now. They're called balloon twisters, fun fact. And no one has ever described my writing in any light terms, so that's pretty nice. I'm going to read two pieces. One is an essay and one is a fiction piece, and they're both from middle places in books. So the only things that you really need to know, the first one is called Empire of Toes, and it's near the fourth section, so near the end of the book. The only things that you need to know is that my aunt has been sick for quite a while at this point, and I start with a quote from her, so that's the voice that's coming in. And the last thing that you should know is that it's filled with diagrams. It's an essay about love and amputation, and the diagrams are meant to help you, should you choose to do this, amputate your own leg and toes and decapitate kings. Not necessarily if you want to, like if it's necessary, it's not imperative. So you can imagine that if you like. Why don't you ever write something I can read, Lena? Why not write something in Spanish or translate something you've already written? Your parents, they tell me all the time, and everyone's read something, everyone but me. It's all only ever in English, and we spend so much time in waiting rooms. I could really read. I would like to if you translated. The toes have turned black, the two at the end. Circulation, lupus, cancer, cortisone, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, therapy, 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 therapy. All of the above, none, some. It doesn't matter. The toes, they have to go. The foot is unevenly swollen, bulging, sporadic, yellow-white blisters traveling down from above the ankle to the tip of my Aunt Cheeky's big toe. The words and proportions are all off, too big and hungry for the confinement of mere blisters and scabs. It is not one whole, but a mismatched union of painful shapes trying to split one from the other, an angry amalgamation faintly reminiscent of a foot. It is a post-colonial map in a children's coloring book, a featherless tropical bird, a bloated chameleon shedding burnt skin. It is a country at war with itself. It is her body at war with itself. It is Colombia 50 years at war with itself. The yellow peels off in thick slices, the pink glistens raw, the brown sinks into crevices, the white stands on end, the black flakes off. The toes are both symptom and cause, consuming and consumed, stuck on a loop. They are the living dead. They cannot return to pink circulation. They will not fall off of their own accord. And if they are to go, it will be neither quietly nor alone. So they scream necrosis up my aunt's leg, beckoning all flesh to join their purple-black empire. And I get an email from my mother that starts with, "Things are complicated," and ends with, "They want to cut both legs off." These toes, they are tremendous. That's what my mother writes from the corner of my aunt's hospital room while nurses unwrap, wrap, and rewrap swollen ankles, blackened flesh. She says the same thing about Alexander the Great. She says that he was short and bent on invasion too. Replication, repetition, reiteration. To name cities and states and rivers after himself, to fill the whole world with Alexander, so that no one could ever cut off any piece of him out without hitting a major artery and making the whole earth bleed out. That's what they want, these two toes, to leave no doubt of themselves, to spread, to reiterate, to name and rename. So I more or less hate them, but I'm also a little in awe too. Anything with such conviction deserves a name, at least. So my mother christens them Pepin the Short and Torquato Tasso. And I look for the torn scrap of paper where I wrote the name my mother gave my knee when I tore it up too. Rodilliquilla María de Los Ángeles Barragán Ortega Camargo y Ortiz Zuleta. It is the current cat's sometimes name, the previous cat's on and off name, the previous cat's more often than not name, and she's named my aunt's toes after her own too. Her tiny toenail-less stumps constantly curled and constantly clawing at the carpet, like a man hanging from the ceiling, by the weeds growing through the cracks, by the nose hairs, by the scalp, as if expecting at any minute for the world to turn upside down, for the sky to stretch out a long plucking claw for a surgeon's pliers and his saw. And all my sisters and nearly all my cousins and I have the same middle name, Lina Maria, Paula Maria, Daniela Maria, Maria Alejandra, Maria Jose, Ana Maria, 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 Maria. And I am determined to name my first daughter after my first niece, and count her toes and name her knees, and draw maps of Alexandria on the soles of her feet, but not yet. For now, these doctors, they're fixing to cut off my aunt's legs, but they don't know her. My aunt, she's tremendous over my dead body, she says. She tells them, you can have my legs when you pry them from my cold, dead hip joints. And she means it. She means to die if they mean to cut, and above all, she means to live, so she does. That's who she is. Though it is too late for Pepin and Torquato, so the doctors saw them off. Or maybe they pluck them off, like black strawberries, to be burnt with all the other orphaned limbs from all the other guerrilla-torn, colonial-scarred orphaned countries. So the foot is folded onto itself like an empanada, to save on stitches and live on smaller scar, my mother tells me, as if one might not notice a three-toed foot on an eight-toed aunt. And though it's no longer very good for walking, it is beautiful and brief and hard to describe, just like the woman who wiggles the three they let her keep. The woman who lets me take pictures with my phone as she reclines and takes another shot of morphine, who turns the handle of the As Seen on TV foldable travel scooter TM I've hauled back from the United States for her until the engine whirls like a swarm of bumblebees strapped in a tin cup, who cuts off taxis and makes children drop their ice cream onto sun-warm sidewalks as she drives it, while I run beside her like mad, trying to keep up, trying, as we speed across cracked streets in Colombia, because that's what the Spaniards said this place was called. As fast as I can, as fast as rubber wheels and torn knees allow through the bright gray light of Bogota, because that's what the indígenas called this muddy plateau before the Spaniards had anything to say about it. I on my leg-only legs and my aunt atop heavy bastard, because that's what I've named the U.S.-made garrote steel-barred travel scooter TM that I've hauled back from the U.S. Just to see if the banged-up scooter still runs, that's what she does. To see if my leg still works, that's what I do. And to see if all that much has changed since her tour of intensive care units and since I left at the age of 17 to justify all the resolute, random, and perfectly planned tragedy that preceded me. So I carry that heavy bastard back through the wide and narrow hallways of airports and airplanes back to Colombia with a metal bar-shaped bruise on my shoulder and 5-inch scar on my knee, like I'm bringing back a fresh kill, like I'm dragging back an anchor, like a wingless dove limping back to the ark with a metal branch in her beak. Just so my aunt might see that she is not so changed to meet the world's stare, and I not so changed for her to have missed anything important, and Colombia to reject me like a faulty transplant. Not changed at all, in fact. A few English words more, a few toes less. But my aunt, see, she's tremendous. Like her toes were tremendous, like the saw that sawed through them and the clippers that clipped through them and the doctor that wielding them snapped bone from bone. She doesn't lie about the pain, doesn't pull her punches, doesn't hide the morphine or the fact that she's thought about it. Doesn't lie about that, and doesn't lie to me either. When she tugs on my sweater and says, Lena, please, please come back and see me. Please come back. Please translate an essay. Please just one. Just for me, Lena. Say you'll come back. And she doesn't write Heavy Bastard ever again either. She stays in instead. Flips through magazines and paper catalogs, points at deals and sales for my mother like she used to do for me, explaining how to get to this store and that store and how this chair right here, do you see it, the reclining one, will finally fix her back and it won't hurt anymore, never again. You'll see, she tells me, you'll see. 4 months indoors while batteries drain and metal rusts, stacks of newspaper and empty pill packets, 4 months. The time it takes to get a medical assistant certificate online, I checked. The time it takes for fetuses to grow toes inside the womb. The time between Alexander's coronation and the burning of Persepolis down to black splinters and white ash. And 40 nameless columns where a great palace once stood, like toenailless stumps sticking out of scorched earth. The time it takes me to break my promise in China, and it takes for her to die in Colombia. Alone in a hospital room, under a tangle of plastic tubes that looked like serpentine roots and vines, as if my orphaned country were reclaiming my orphaned aunt, while I walked through a Chinese night on my broken leg-only leg with a limp-only limp.
So that's cheery. So I'm going to read something that is slightly less so. And this is from a novel I'm currently working on. It's about the devil. It's tentatively called The Devil Takes Seven Souls, but I don't know if I can keep that title because I've killed a lot more people than that so far. The only things that you need to know are that this is the fourth and the first section, so it's a little bit onward, and that there is no Judeo-Christian rules apply to my universe, to my cosmology. The devil has been alone a long time in the unmade earth, and it's basically just covered in mud. I think that's all you need to know. And then along come these things I call the makers, and they're thinking about what should be made, if it should be made, should they choose to make it. So that's what you need to know. Bear with me. It'll make sense. Probably not. It doesn't matter. Okay, this is called The God of Obtuse Angles. The devil woke up to a drifting sky as a slow current carried away his ever-drifting canoe. He cleared his throat and rubbed his eyes, looking for the makers floating above the horizon, and as soon as he did, he began paddling with his bare claws until he was floating right below their circle, and then he laid flat on his back at the bottom of the boat once more, just as he had for unnumbered days, because there were not yet days to number. And he liked it there, like laying down and feeling his canoe begin to drift away again while listening to the makers' voices, while trying to imagine what men would sound like and prairies would look like and women would dance like when the makers were done remaking the world. No, they said, brushing away shapes and starting anew. Acute angles, that's what. While the devil leaned forward and hung his head over the edge of his canoe. Straight. Another maker hummed, and the devil rubbed his eyes with his claws, and he thought to himself, what are angles? Approximate right angles, another maker interjected. The devil took a deep breath, and puffing out his cheeks, he stuck his whole head into the mud. Thick gray bubbles gurgled up while the mud tried to slip into his ears, nose, and mouth, tried to find a way inside him, to fill him up and pull him down, as the muffled sound of the maker's voices found its way into the mud itself. Moving angles, rotator cuffs, and, one maker said, sap, another concluded. The devil pulled his head out like a cork from a bottle. He filled his lungs with swamp-steamed air, and he shook his head furiously until his fur stuck out in muddy spikes. Then he rubbed his eyes again, looked up at the blurry circle of beings hovering above him, and whispered, angle, angle, angle. He growled softly from the pit of his stomach, and if the makers had been within his reach, he might have tried to stick his claw down their throats like a magician's hand into a hat to try to pull out the sound. Angle, angle, angle. But the makers were too far up to catch, and too busy clicking their tongues and shaking their heads while they drew spirals and grids and lines stretching out into infinite horizons. So the devil sat back down on his canoe and repeated softly, angle, angle. Attempting to force a mouthful of fangs to hold a delicate sound without killing it. 60 between each section, a maker traced six-sided shape in the mist, 120 straight across, and the rest nodded their heads and clicked their tongues in unison. But the devil spoke up, while some makers waved away the invisible shapes and others turned their eyes down toward him. What is an angle? Ah, a few makers said, by then accustomed to the devil's interruptions. It is a... A maker drew a cross in the air, this and this and this and this, pointing to the corners of each of the windowpane spaces made by the intersecting lines. These are right angles all, opposite angles too, adjacent as well, but they are not opposite or adjacent because they are right. The maker nodded to himself. They are adjacent because they are opposite and they so happen to be right. The maker turned down toward the devil. See? He, in turn, tugged on the hair on his chin and furrowed his brow. He muttered. Another maker waved away the cross and began drawing a horned devil head in the air. Like the changing space inside your mouth as you open it, see?
The devil's ears perked up, and standing up straight, he pointed at his mouth. Yes, in a way, it's like the space between the lines of teeth. The maker paused, and the devil tapped on the front of his teeth with his claw. If your jaw were to stretch out into infinity, the devil's eyes widened, and he covered his mouth with his claw, and the files of teeth grew out in perfect straight lines into forever. The devil sucked in his lips and looked concerned. If that, though also if not that, another maker waved away the lines stretching out from the invisible devil head and tried again. That is, the maker continued, the size of the bite you could take depends on how wide you open your mouth. The devil perked up once more, and slowly he opened his mouth. Yes, the maker nodded, that's right. Okay, the devil said, angles, opening and closing his mouth until his teeth clicked and clacked. Three makers looked at one another. Here, one of them drew a closed devil mouth like a single line of locked teeth. See this? The maker said, pointing at the line made by the rows of locked teeth, and then at the invisible jaw hinges. No angle, no space, no bite. The maker looked down. The devil nodded knowingly once more, tapping his chin and pretending to draw shapes of his own in the air with his claw. Yes, yes, I see. Angle now. The maker traced a shape in the mist, the tiny angle of a devil mouth wide enough only to sip rainwater from the bottom of his canoe. Now bite also. The devil turned his head and the maker stared at the mist. Small bite, small angle. Then the other makers clicked their tongues and hissed in agreement while the devil tugged on the hair on his chin. He mumbled again. That is like what it is, which is also what it is, the maker concluded, and the devil looked perplexed. Yes, he nodded eagerly. This, sticking his claw in his mouth and plucking the inside of his cheek like the string of a harp. Angle. Got it. Well, the maker said, not quite, but close to it. And yes, also that, in ways. Some makers whistled and clicked their tongues, while others continued drawing arcs, lines, and overlapping circles. It's more than that, the maker said, almost absent-mindedly as he continued to draw, continually opening devil mouth. More the lines of it, the ones inside holding it together and pulling it apart, the trajectory of it out forever. A devil head drawn with a bare finger in the mist, a mouth opening wider and wider and wider still, but really the teeth only, if they were a line, which of course they also are, but if you could imagine teeth that went out forever forwards, which sometimes they do, and forever backwards too. The devil narrowed his eyes and furrowed his brow as the maker stared at the short distance and continued tracing a devil mouth opening wider and wider and wider like a clam pried open with a crowbar. In a way, that is what it is and what it is like. And as the lines of the invisible devil head began splitting farther and farther apart, the devil clutched the hinges of his own jaw and imagined he could feel the skin of his cheeks begin to stretch and rip. Though only if, another maker added, while the first continued to draw mindlessly. If the teeth were perfectly so and corresponded exactly and met just right, which they also do, of course, sometimes. 60-degree gaping devil mouth, 90-degree, 100, 120, the devil's heart raced while holding his jaw shut with his claws and watching in dismay as the invisible devil jaw was ripped apart, cracked open, split down the middle, and made into one continuous stretch of teeth like so many nails hammered through a wooden plank. There, a maker said, 180-degree angle. A split coconut devil aperture. A horned head like the broken spine of a book, and a real devil below it in his canoe, holding back a scream. Yes, the other maker stared at the ripped apart devil head in the air. Kind of like that, they said, and then another continued, but also watching the devil dig his claws into his face to keep it from bursting open. Not that either. The same maker finished the sentence and leaned down toward the hyperventilating devil, whimpering softly. Also not at all like that. The devil loosened his grip. Also not at all at all. The same maker whistled, a high note and then a very low note, and all the makers turned toward the devil in unison. An angle is more, the whistling maker started drawing a straight line path in the air, like the space between you and us. And drawing a second line intersecting the first, he said, if we were both moving and you could see every stationary point in that moving path. The devil furrowed his brow and began to breathe normally once more. If those paths were to intersect, which of course they do and must and have, mud boiled and swirled below them, and the devil wiped pinpricks of gray blood from where he had dug his claws, it is like, another maker tried, the mud between the wake of your canoe on the surface. He drew a simple straight line across the air again. If another canoe were to cross over the first wake, he drew a second straight line across the first. Then there is an angle, four, in fact. The devil looked up at where the invisible lines met and up at the hovering circle of identical creatures with identical features and not a single horn among them. The universe is full of angles, the makers concluded, touching the invisible vertex where the imaginary path met, as if plucking a note from a very delicate instrument. Then the devil looked down at his canoe and back at the fading, lonely mud track behind it. It would be better, another maker spoke, if there were more than one canoe, more than one line. And while the makers clicked their tongues in agreement, another you, maybe. Yes, the makers nodded and clicked their tongues. It would be easier to explain with another you. So the devil looked down at his claws. He felt the lines of his horn stretching out into infinity, never crossing each other's path, and he tried to imagine another devil paddling toward him from a great gray horizon while the makers brushed away rows of flat devil teeth from the fog. Angles need more than one line to exist, they said. And as the makers began drawing every sort of angle above the devil's head, he and his one and only canoe drifted away slowly. Thank you.
Good evening. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Victoria Flanagan. I'm a third-year poetry and nonfiction student in the MFA program here at VCU. I've graciously been given the opportunity to introduce tonight's second reader, Mark Doty. As I sat down to write this introduction, I asked myself, could I really name my first encounter with a Doty poem? I read Tiara in undergrad, and I was whelmed by it. My Alexandria was one of the first collections of poetry I read cover to cover. And of course, our first discovered influences are often our most beloved and consistent teachers. But I couldn't actually pin down a moment of first exposure. So rather, I'll just say that it's been a constant. For as long as I've read and studied poetry, I read and studied Mark Doty. This, I think, is emblematic. In talking with my peers, I've realized that this is true for so many readers and writers who list Doty as an influence. We forward and pass on his essays and poems, collections and memoirs, and we do it with, I think, a rare degree of certainty. We don't simply suspect that it will be meaningful or helpful or inspiring to the unsuspecting, the unfamiliar, those that I would label as pre-Doty. Rather, we know and trust that it's likely to spark something for others, just as something was and continues to be sparked within us. Mark Doty is the author of over a dozen books of poetry and prose, including Deep Lane, published by W.W. Norton in 2015, and Fire to Fire, New and Selected Poems, which was published by HarperCollins in 2008, and which received the National Book Award. His writing has earned him numerous other awards, including a Whiting Writers Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Penn Martha Albrand Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Award, and the T.S. Eliot Prize. He's the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, among others. He teaches at Rutgers University, and he's currently the Kapnick Distinguished Writer in Residence at the University of Virginia. But this is all just a restatement of the obvious. Mark Doty's body of work is staggering. In both scope and luster, it circulates widely. And it's tempting to say this is a result of his consistent discussion and recontextualizing of that which we, as Doty's own work suggests, ought to consider essential. The relation of the self to the outside world, the relation of the self to others, and the grand cosmological coincidence of togetherness and singularity. But I'd argue his work is so pervasive because it is essential in what it contributes to literature's current moment. Often called a poet of description, one who places his subjects gingerly under a magnifying glass, Doty's work observes and sees through, speaks to larger truth through the smaller instance, object, or moment. But his attention is not singular. His attention never forgets its broader context. In Doty's universe, the claw of a backhoe is more than its most obvious metaphor. It is an invitation, a callback through time, an inevitability. And of course, the display of mackerel is more than a display of mackerel. but a row of fish cannot be so miraculous and improbable without the speaker's gaze, without an appropriate amount of willingness and faith on the part of that speaker, that the universe will deliver up not only something to command our attention, but something worthy of it. What I admire most about Dodie's work is that it reminds us that writing can be both selfish and democratic. Where so often poems observe and then expound, bend toward abstraction, or observe as a mode of self-denial, Dodie's poems reach toward others generously and purposefully. With enviable poise and clear-headedness, Dodie's metaphors reach out, away from the self, in a way that's not tinged with abnegation. A woman preaching in a subway station, a kid reciting poems in a bookstore, these characters become expansions of the self, characters distinct and tender and a kind of context. This is all to say, I return again and again to Dodie's work for its humanness, for its engagement with a larger human experience. At a time when I imagine most of us need to be reminded of the world's humanity, his careful attention and observation is expansive, a broadening of the self as part of, rather than a self distinct from. His work makes no space for even the word outsider. By devoting such careful attention to the various disasters of living, the constant threat of mortality, the risk inherent in love, the knowledge that intimacy cannot exist without distance too, Dodie assures us that our anxiety and griefs are necessary. He underscores the human capacity for empathy in the face of tragedy, no matter the scale. And perhaps more importantly, his work, when we need it most, reinforces Dodie's own often quoted notion that there is joy and pleasure in the world if only you look. Please join me in welcoming Mark Dodie.
Hi. So I'm going to try to be really loud up here, okay? Because I know this mic seems to swallow sound a little bit. Is that level okay? I'm not yelling at you, am I? Okay, hey, good. Victoria, where'd you go? Thank you. That was a beautiful introduction. It's extremely thoughtful, and I feel read, you know? Not like by a drag queen, you know, but read in a profound and thoughtful way. Thank you very much. And I am very, very pleased to read here wonderful poets, a remarkable group of faculty, Kathy Graber, David Wojahn, Greg, terrific. And I can't come here without remembering, too, the late Larry Levis, who, to my mind, was one of the great poets of the second half of the 20th century, and much of his work was written here. So I also want to thank the writer series for choosing this photograph, which is a very apt illustration of my inner life at this moment. I woke up this morning not feeling so great. I feel like a headache and a bug coming on, and that's my interiority right there, so you are forewarned. So David Wojahn has a terrific poem about marriage, and in it is the line, "Marriage is a pact with the memory of another." Which is certainly true. When we join ourselves to another person, we are sort of entering into their remembered life and sharing their memory. I have learned in the last few years that marriage is also a pact with the pets of another. Having had big dogs much of my life, I have my first terrier. His name is George. The title of this poem flows directly into the text. Little George barks at whatever is not the world as he prefers to know it. Trash sacks, hand trucks, black hats, canes and hoods, bicycles, snow shovels, someone smoking a joint beneath the overhang of the Haitian evangelicals. Anyone, how dare they, walking a dog. George barks, the tense white comma of himself arced in alarm. At home, he floats in the creaturely domestic, curled in the triangle behind a sleeper's knees, wiggling on his back on the sofa, all jelly and size, requesting, receiving a belly rub. No worries. But outside the apartment's metal door, the unmanageable day assumes its blurred and infinite disguises. Best to bark. No matter that he's slightly larger than a toaster, he proceeds as if he rules a rectangle two blocks deep bounded west and east by 7th Avenue and Union Square. Whatever's there is there by his consent. And subject to the rebuke of his refusal, though when he asserts his will, he trembles. If only he were not solely responsible for raising outcry at any ripple of trouble on West 16th, or if right out on the pavement he might lay down the clanking armor of his bluster. Some evening, when he's climbed the stairs after our late walk, and rounds the landing's turn and turns his way toward his steady sleep,
I wish he might be visited by a dream of the world as kind. How any looming unreadable might turn out to hold the April green of an unsullied tennis ball. Dear one, surely the future is not entirely out to get us. And if it is, barking won't help much. But no such luck, at least not yet. He takes umbrage this morning at a stone image serene in a neighbor's garden and stiffens and fixes and sounds his wild alarm. Damn you, Buddha, get out of here, go away. You know, when you're writing about dogs, you are, of course, writing about people. And for a while, I thought this was a portrait of my partner and his anxiety sort of reflected in George. Then I realized it was actually about me. This poem has to do with arriving at one of those birthdays with a zero at the end. And I have never been bothered by this in the past. You know, 40, 50, I felt more myself, you know, more standing on my own ground, knowing what I wanted. My 60th birthday, I spent in bed. And I know better. You know, many of the people I know who are the most alive, vital, sexy, interesting people are in their 60s or 70s, but it's still, this culture puts a whammy on us. You know, it says 60 is like you start to drift off into nothing, basically. It would be useful for this poem to visualize fire balloons or sky lanterns, which are those rice paper constructions with bamboo ribs, and you light a wick underneath, and the heat makes it take off. Elizabeth Bishop, in her poem The Armadillo, calls them frail, illegal fire balloons. And they're illegal for really good reasons. You know? 60. Dangerous invitations, packed flat. 6 sky lanterns for my birthday. Rice paper sack glued at the seams. Thin bamboo ring at bottom for a mouth. A wire armature holding a deck of cards, stack of paper, soaked in wax. Frail, illegal, we know. But this birthday ends in zero. Turn, I'm not so inclined to celebrate. And who could resist a lantern lifted by its own flame, sailing out over an August night's black bay? At Land's End, no other car in sight, only the deep, unfractioned evening bent immensely down toward a horizon it erased. And here, in our flashlit circle, a blonde grass edge of dune, a bit of pavement, and just in case, a fire extinguisher. We huddle around the first, one for each decade past, one for the one to come. Unfold the paper shell, hold the opening level, touch a lighter to the wick, and feel in our four hands the thing swell, tugging upward, a bucking saffron lung. We couldn't hold back a moment longer. Who knew, till that first one rose, how lovely this token would be, lit from within, ghosting its arcs from side to side, hurrying into the smallest point it could become before it disappeared. And there were still 5 more to go, restless in our hands. My life wanted to be born another time between us, to tear upward and become animal, winking fire, and make in air the shape it would make, this and no other. Write the night enormous. Is that what souls are for? Drunk on my birthday wine, maybe having smoked a little too, you'd miscount it and hadn't brought one more for the years ahead. Thank you, love. You'd meant to, but some guiding instinct, wisdom, stayed your hand and left the last lantern folded and waiting on a shelf, the better part of your gift. Like so many of us, I have been horrified, appalled by the visibility of racially motivated violence on the part of law enforcement agencies around the country. People who are our employees, people we ask to uphold and protect the lives and dignity of citizens. I felt unable to talk about this until the death of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy who was shot in a city park in Cleveland, Ohio, because he was playing with a plastic gun. Again, the first line pours, or the title rather, pours right into the first line. In 2 seconds, the boy's face climbed back down the 12-year tunnel of its becoming, a charcoal sunflower swallowing itself. Who has eyes to see or ears to hear? If you could see what happens fastest, unmaking the human irreplaceable, a star falling into complete gravitational darkness from all points of itself, all this, the held, loved body, into which entered milk and music, honeying the cells of him, who sang to him, stroked the nap of the scalp, kissed the flesh knot, after the cord completed its work of fueling into him the long history of those whose suffering was made more bearable by the as yet unknown of him, playing alone in some unthinkable future city, a Cleveland, whatever that might be. 2 seconds to elapse. the arc of joy in the conception bed, the labor of hands repeated until the hands no longer required attention, so that as the woman folded, her hopes for him sank into the fabric of his shirts and underpants. Down they go, swirling down into the maw of a greater dark. Treasure box, comic books, pocket knife, bell from a lost cat's collar. Why even begin to enumerate them when behind every tributary poured into him comes rushing backward all he hasn't been yet? Everything that boy could have thought or made, sung or theorized, built on the quavering but continuous structure that had preceded him, sank into an absence in the shape of a boy playing with a plastic gun in a city park in Ohio in the middle of the afternoon. When I say 2 seconds, I don't mean the time it took him to die. I mean the lapse between the instant the cruiser braked to a halt on the grass, between that moment and the one in which the officer fired his weapon, the 2 seconds taken to assess the situation. And though I believe it is the work of art to try on at least the moment and skin of another, for this hour, I respectfully decline. I refuse it. May that officer be visited every night of his life by an enormity collapsing in front of him into an incomprehensible bloom, and the voice that howls out of it. If this is no poem, then... But that voice, erased boy, beloved of time, who did nothing to no one and became nothing because of it, I know that voice is one of the things we call poetry. It isn't to his killer he's speaking. So I have most of my life thought of myself as a poet who would reach for empathy. And to be confronted with a situation where I felt that empathy was basically obscene, to say, no, we must, as a society, say, no, we will not understand that, we will not accept it. And it still feels strange to me to read a poem without empathy in that way. I mean, it's empathy for Tamir Rice, but not for the cop, right? So I had a really interesting experience this spring. I was invited by Harvard to write the Phi Beta Kappa poem, which is presented at graduation. They commission a different poet every year. And the first thing that came into my head was that the poem I know best that was a Phi Beta Kappa poem, Elizabeth Bishop's The Moose, an unbelievably great poem, which she had started 27 years before she finished it. So she had 27 years to tinker, you know? I didn't have that kind of time. And my assignment was to write a poem that spoke to the conditions of American life now. Interesting assignment. I live in New York City, and I'm very aware of, as all New Yorkers are, real estate. What's your apartment worth? When did you get it? What's happening there? What's happening to the building next door? We all talk about that. We try not to, but we can't stop ourselves. And a new concept, at least new to me, has appeared. Do you guys know what air rights are? Like, if you live in a valuable piece of property, it might be that somebody would like to buy the rights to build something on top of you, like over your roof. And this has become a big deal in Manhattan, like selling your air rights, which you didn't even know you had, you know, and making large sums of money on it. So that gets in here. The poem occurs at a moment when the position formerly known as leader of the free world is occupied by a real estate developer. So here we go. It's a big poem. If you get lost for a minute, don't worry. There's another train coming down the track. You can get on the next one. No problem. I think, you know, selective listening is just fine. It's called Air Rights. And there are lines from two other poets that come up. You'll hear them. One is from Elizabeth Alexander, who said, "We are of interest to one another. Are we not?" And the other is from the late Linda Hall, who said, "We will seek that thing that doth shine and so torment us." Air writes, "Red brick, never much on looks, leaning in the direction of Romanesque. The French church settled into modest circumstances. How many decades on West 16th? Nothing divine in the details. Veneer peeling from doors never meant for here, never open, no light evenings through colored glass. Though by day you could discern, 20 feet above the sidewalk, Christ stepping onto the waters of Galilee, sea and savior, oiled by exhaust, nearly indistinguishable. Weeknights the lamps burned downstairs, where a dozen groups renounced at length alcohol or crystal, skin or smoke, and what each circle resisted glowed at the center of their ring of chairs, nearly visible. There you could consecrate relinquishment, or find someone already ruined to pursue whatever made you, for the night, unsinkable. The rent collected each time they passed the hat kept the church afloat. Of the congregation, 8 souls remained, Haitian evangelicals. only once did I see someone mount the stairs toward those slapdash doors. Who could have missed her? Under a plane tree, visibly considering giving up all ambition, an idling town car's rear door opened, she stepped out. And I knew at once that if she'd ever for a moment been thwarted, she simply summoned more of some alloy of metal and will she drew up from beneath the pavement, maybe from Haiti itself, from generations that stood unbending in her, compromising with nothing in her green hat, her capacious black purse. She conquered the stairs, and though she only raised her hand to open the door, it seemed she waved to her subjects in the provinces, gracious, unencumbered, just once. The meeting schedule disappeared from the basement entry's wire-woven glass. The room stayed dark, addicts no longer smoking and talking under the miserable tree. Twilights, before they were gone, I'd walk through a climate so thick I could almost taste it, meet the gaze of men whose eyes locked into mine. Was this the night they knew was coming, the night they'd fall? I recognized them. I wanted to put my hand into the wound at their sides, that we might be real to one another. A barrier went up around the entry, papered with signs and permits. An artist's rendering descended out of the blue, 14 stories clad in bluestone, suspended above the freshened brick of the church. A flyer in our vestibule said they'd sold the space between their sanctuary and heaven for a cool $8 million, and units in what would be the highest step-back Nineveh tower on our block. Raise the faithful high, plunge the neighbors into shadow. Lord, thou preparest a banquet for me. Workers boxed the plane tree's trunk in a cage of 2x4s. Heavy equipment scooped a new foundation, hammered the pilings in. How do they stand it in Cairo or Rome when any shaft in sand reaches down 5,000 years? Bad enough in New York. Artifacts of quarantine and revolt, bullets that did or didn't strike the rioters, squatters or immigrants, Irish or black. Cemetery slabs etched with the hex of David Starr. Oyster middens. Crockery stamped with eagles and shields. In the Historical Society, dug from a site like this one, the object I can't forget, plutonium half-life still ticking, nightmare thing, brass shackles finally made, locked into place by a brass bar sized to fit the wrists of a child of 4. That sign the angel placed outside of Eden, forbidding re-entry, no arrow, but those joined zeros fetched up out of the mud, though their poison goes on seeping into the water table. The backhoe clawed, rebarb spiked its way up, and some days traffic stopped while the concrete mixer's big rotating drum poured into place more of the solid substance of our block. The city stopped work more than once. I saw where they'd poured the footing a little short, workers float a 3-inch layer along the top of the foundation. Sure to crack, perhaps one day to bring the whole thing down. Though walking home, after hours, late winter, I found towering at the center of the night what seemed a vertical representation of heaven, 9 episodes of the Exaltations of Light, an unfinished model of the Spirit's progress, a pilgrim ladder. Where did it lead? Half finished, a swath of black netting veiling the lamps left burning within. That building would never be so beautiful again. Up there, above the streets, might not desire be articulated, spoken till seen through? Now the Bradford pears open against scaffolding crowning the new Barneys down the block, and black girders sketch out more floors above a French church caged in spars of steel, wave-walking Jesus shadowed by bristling sports above. Do the faithful look up toward a future in a world of light, more square feet? More power to them if they do. Who doesn't want a privacy to fill with memory or hope, or the sheer luxury of an amplitude unfilled, room for the self to billow out in dreaming? The shadow pooling in my streets grown colder, gained in depth. Sometimes I walk a city block and notice that everyone's looking at a screen or talking to someone who's somewhere else, so that here seems to thin out, dispersed and characterless. I miss the attics. You understand I've done time in that school of longing and resistance, a sometimes citizen of the knot I threaded through, nights on my way to anywhere, under that tree the builders wanted to kill outright. They've chopped it to a broken, one-branched arm of a tree. Nearly everything we said beneath it concerned our endless desires, the thing that doth shine and so torment us. Our coins passed from hand to hand until the inscriptions all but wore away. At least we said them to each other, those old longings. We are of interest to one another, Are we not? The evangelical woman, she of the superb hat, will she look down from that glassy paradise and find me of interest? Or the men and women who unroll blankets over flattened cardboard under Barney's stainless awning, its steel cloud sheen? They sleep and dream all night before a chamber gleaming with refusal, inviting no one in, sealed plate glass displaying, ready, necklaces, shown on stylized shoulders, under relentless halogen, shining. 10 feet away, tulips in iron-edged rectangles wrap wings around their furnace flames, heat drawn up from the center of the earth, a strength never bridled yet, even the mutilated tree aurid in a froth of green. No intention to quit, none whatsoever. The blank surface of the tower offers fewer chances to engage. An old church's ramshackle intimacy shrinks beneath what we all see coming. A seamless facade interested only in itself, dwarfing the red brick it doesn't crush because why should it? The air rights are for sale. Fit yourself around whatever it is you want. Pay them some fraction enormous in their eyes, but nothing to the unreal numbers you'll accrue. Build, build, and keep on display what you swallowed to erect this chilly Babel tower on my block. I'm all judgment, I know. The congregation won't regret the sale of light and air. And those who sleep on 7th Avenue, their midnights raked by precious glitter, on the space between their skulls and the Empyrean, no one puts a price. The new tower's a glacial expanse, the tulips ember in their spiky bed. We dwell down here, in shadow and in spring. So I have a favor to ask you. I don't have my book Deep Lane here. I know there's some outside. Would somebody grab me a Deep Lane, or may I borrow one from you? And I just want to read a couple poems from that, and we're done. Lots of the poems in this book are called Deep Lane. Deep Lane is a real place, the road in Amagansett, New York. But what I really love is the name of it, the two monosyllables, and the sense of the way it sort of seems to pull you forward and down. It became a kind of mantra for me, generating many meanings. Ned is my golden retriever. You met George, didn't you, through the door. Deep Lane, June 23rd, evening of the first fireflies. We're walking in the cemetery down the road, and I look up from my distracted study of whatever, an unfocused gaze somewhere a few feet in front of my shoes, and see that Ned has run on ahead, with a champagne plume of his tail held especially high, his head erect, which is often a sign that he has something he believes he is not allowed to have. And in the gathering twilight, what is it that is gathered? Who is doing the harvesting? I can make out that the long horizontal between his lovely jaws is one of the four stakes planted on the slope to indicate where the backhoe will dig a new grave. Of course, my impulse is to run after him, to replace the marker, out of respect for the rule that we won't desecrate the tombs, or at least for those who knew the woman, whose name inks a placard in the rectangle claimed by the four poles of vanishing. Three poles now. And how it's within their recollection, their gathering, she'll live. Evening of memory, spark lamps in the grass. I stand and watch him go in his wild figure eights. I say, you run, darling, you tear up that hill. I read that poem 2 years ago now in London. It's a very fancy reading with the Royal Society of Literature. And there are a lot of young women, quite elegant young women, who work for the Royal Society, and they often have bad days. And they adopted the last line of that poem as a kind of motto to spur one another. You run, darling, you tear up that hill. It's wonderful, I loved it. A great fate for a poem. Okay, so this last poem, it will be useful to visualize hydrangeas. You know, those summer flowers that are usually blue or pink, but the colors get a lot more interesting and complicated as time passes. This is called Spent. Late August morning, I go out to cut spent and faded hydrangeas, washed greens, russets, troubled little auras of sky, as if these were the very silks of Versailles, modeled by rain and ruin, then half restored after all this time. When I come back with my handful, I realize I've accidentally locked the door and can't get back into the house. The dining room window's easiest. Crawl through beauty bush and spirea, push aside some strict errant maples, take down the wood frame screen, hoist myself up. But how exactly to clamber across the sill and radiator down to the tile? I push myself up so that my waist rests against the sill and lean forward, place my hands on the floor, and begin to slide down into the room, which makes me think this was what it was like to be born. Awkward. Too big for the passageway. Negotiate? Submit? When I give myself to gravity, there I am, inside, no harm, the dazzling splotchy flower heads scattered around me on the floor. Will leaving the world be the same? Uncertainty as to how to proceed, some discomfort, and suddenly you're where? I am so involved with this idea, I forget to unlock the door. So when I go to fetch the mail, I'm locked out again. Am I at home in this house? Would I prefer to be out here, where I could be almost anyone? This time, it's simpler. The window frame, the radiator, my descent. Born twice in one day. In their silver jug, these bruise-blessed flowers, how hard I had to work to get them into this room. When I say spent, I don't mean they have no further coin. If there are lives to come, I think they might be a little easier than this one. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here.